Welcome to the ONC PCOR Research Data Use Scenarios Work Group Meeting Number 7. My name is Hilda, and I will be your operator for today. At this time, all participants' lines are unmuted. Please self-mute your lines. If you wish to ask a question, please use the WebEx to raise your hand or send your questions to Catherine Donaldson via the chat function. If you are not signed into WebEx and wish to ask a question, please announce yourself on the phone, stating your name and affiliation. Please also note that this conference is being recorded. And I would now like to turn the call over to Priscilla Dulab.
Thank you. So good afternoon, everyone. This is our seventh multi-stakeholder meeting, and so we have just passed the halfway mark for these bi-weekly meetings. And, you know, from the team, we just want to say thank you very much for all of the inputs as we've, you know, started developing and defining the various research data use scenarios. Next slide. My name is Priscilla, and joining me on the call from the NORC team, we have Lauren, Braden, and Catherine. We have our colleagues from George Washington University, Jane Thorpe, Lara Cartwright-Smith, and Elizabeth Gray. And we also have Daniela Mika. And joining us from ONC, we have Helen. I know that there are a large number of members of the multi-stakeholder group that are signing to the WebEx. And so we will certainly note, you know, all of you as participants for this meeting. I'm not going to go through everyone's name because there's quite a few of you on the call. So next slide. So for the purposes of today's call, we are going to now again focus on three new scenarios that we've developed. We have focused on one around patient-reported outcomes. So you will see, you know, the process that was used in terms of how PROs were collected for the purposes of developing a registry. We have another focus on patient-generated health data, particularly around the use of sensor data for PCOR. And then finally, we've also developed a scenario focused on subpopulations. And Daniela will walk through each of these scenarios that we've developed with input from both, you know, the team at GW and ONC. And we've raised some, you know, questions for all of you and, you know, for us to get some more feedback as we define these scenarios. And then, you know, as is typical, we will also provide an update on our previous scenarios and give you sort of a window into some of the things that we are working on in the subsequent meetings. Okay? So just as a reminder, you know, to all of you, and I know you, many of you have seen the slide, as we develop in each of the scenarios, we have some key questions that, you know, we are trying to answer, you know, depending on the different sort of uses of the data, the different types of data, and, you know, the different types of sort of research studies that are being undertaken. Next slide. Okay. So at this point, I'm going to hand it over to Daniela to walk us through each of the three scenarios. I just want to remind the participants on the call that, you know, we are obviously very interested in your input. So, you know, if you raise your hands, we will be sure to call upon you and, you know, get your feedback. Okay, Daniela, I'm handing it over to you at this point.
Thanks, Priscilla. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, we're coming through loud and clear.
So this first scenario, I'm hoping that it will be familiar to at least some of you that have been participating in some of the CMS bundled payment programs. The project is actually that inspired this was actually something that really happened in California that was led by the California Joint Replacement Registry. And it's a sort of exemplary of many of the kinds of experiences I think a number of us have had as part of trying to capture patient-reported outcomes and particularly capturing patient-reported outcomes as they're connected with the healthcare system. So if I'm not seeing something that's representative of your experience when I'm describing this scenario, please pipe in and certainly help describe some alternatives in this. So the context of this particular project was that there was a federally funded program that was administered by the state of California to create a joint replacement registry that would collect the functional status outcomes, primarily functional status outcomes, from patients that had recently undergone total hip and knee replacement surgeries. And these patient-reported outcomes are now part of bundled payment quality measures and are increasingly becoming part of what a number of health systems are implementing. But over the course of this project, a lot of challenges were revealed. So the project leader had done what she could to convene all of the different health systems that were participating in the project and try to the extent possible to standardize the protocols. But what she found was that the governance of this kind of thing was all over the map. So in some cases, the collection of patient-reported outcomes was very much considered a standard practice, but only as part of research. So this activity got routed the IRB, and some of the IRBs considered it to be human subjects research, others did not consider it to be human subjects research, and so slightly different protocols were approved in those scenarios. And still other health systems actually considered it to be part of quality improvement because these patient-reported outcomes were being used in quality measures. So that was sort of something that was challenging, and I think fairly typical in terms of not having sort of a common understanding of where patient-reported outcomes fall in the continuum of research and TPO. And the other item that was happening technically in this project was just that some sites had already been collecting patient-reported outcomes as part of either their patients' personal health records or in the EHRs themselves, and continued to go down the path of collecting them through that system, and others had to set up new data collection systems de novo that were either online or in some kind of devices that were placed in the clinical setting. So this is sort of the history of this project. It was very successful and has since become part of the American Joint Replacement Registry, and it does expose a lot of different issues, and there's not time to talk about all of them, I don't think, today, but there's some great papers that were published in eGEMS around this, and I'm sure at least some of you are familiar with them. Some of the questions that have come up that we'd really like to get your input on this particular scenario is how the patient perspective could have been captured and how patients might influence this kind of data collection and data management procedures. This is a taxpayer-funded effort, obviously intended to help patients, where it was not really clear how best to capture the voices of patients. And, you know, sort of related to that is whether it's feasible for the patients to be put kind of at the center of this process and have them collect their own data from the electronic health records and submit that with the patient-reported outcomes to a registry like this, and then what kind of implications that would have for bias in the data and validity, both from a quality measurement and a research standpoint, and then, you know, what other things are related on the privacy and ethics perspective to the use in a registry where there's sort of this continuum of perceptions of something being research and quality improvement. I sort of mentioned before, and this is something that we should sort of be discussing in all of these scenarios, is, you know, has anybody successfully been able to get alignment in multi-institutional projects like this on how these kinds of cases are judged by their IRBs and their legal and compliance offices? And this particular story seems to be really rife with so many different interpretations of the different health systems on what was actually being done and what categories it fell into. So if people have had a success with that, I think it would be wonderful to capture that as part of this discussion. And then in California, there's a cancer registry that is mandated, and health systems are submitting data to it all the time. About, I think it's almost 97% of cancer cases are captured in the California Cancer Registry, and it has an IRB and a fairly robust process for use of that data for research, even though it's created for public health purposes. And despite this, the health systems really didn't see the patient-reported outcome registry as being similar in any way, and it went through a completely different process. So, you know, there's a question of, you know, how might the at the other end of the spectrum from how the patients might be involved in the process, you know, how might the government be involved in this process? And then Finally, this registry had its own IRB, and it had to work in coordination with the IRBs of the health systems, and the health systems even had their own IRBs. Some of them deferred to the Western IRB. And what kinds of opportunities are there to streamline that governance? So I just to pause there, and this is a whole suite of questions. Really like to hear from you guys, your perspectives and experiences with this kind of thing.
So this is Peter Emby. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Hi. So you're right. It's a lot of questions and a lot to sort through. There certainly are examples I'm familiar with, both here at Ohio State and through collaborations with professional societies and the like, where we and others have engaged in efforts to define what are the critical data elements, what needs to be captured discreetly as sort of a minimal data set for a particular disease entity, and then work on basically adjusting templates and workflows and the like to be able to capture those through routine practice for multiple purposes, including quality improvement, administrative purposes, and then downstream research. The decisions about whether or not to consent patients, of course, depends on whether one wants to use identifiable data downstream and sort of what you're going to do with the information from a research perspective. And yet, we have experience, for instance, in declaring that we were going to use the data in de-identified purpose for research in addition to the other uses, and thereby not collecting upfront consent for that use because of the identified nature of the data, but then doing that activity does limit, what one can do. So there's a number of different questions that you've posed that I think could be answered by the group. I'm sure there are others on the call that have similar experiences, and I can think of other examples in the literature as well. Just not sure exactly what would be most helpful at this point. If you could say a little bit more about how you think we could move this forward as a group to inform what you're trying to achieve, I'm just not entirely clear.
Sir, I don't know if anybody on the GW team would like to speak to Peter's question about what would be most useful for them. I would say from a high level, we're seeking all kinds of input on what's been successful in order to inform a legal and ethical framework, but I think the you guys from GW can probably respond effectively to what the focus of this is.
Thanks, Danielle. This is Jane from GW. I think at this point, if there's examples that folks can share directly that they can send, by email or point us towards reports or studies that have been done that address some of these questions, would be incredibly helpful. And I think for purposes of our discussion today, if there is a particular example or something that would sort of yield discussion amongst the group, that would be helpful as well. But I think what we're looking for too is we're thinking about sort of the legal and ethical framework is sort of concrete examples from the field about the actions being taken or not taken, the steps being taken or not taken. And then our goal is then to sort of think about that from a legal and ethical perspective and sort of identify where there may be gaps, where there are opportunities, or where there are perceived barriers that in fact actually may not be true barriers.
Yeah. And I think the questions that Priscilla mentioned on the earlier slide, I think those are what we're looking for the answers to. So if that prompts any thoughts in your mind.
Hi, everyone. This is Loria Pollack, and I'm speaking from the CDC. I work with the National Program of Cancer Registry, so I just wanted to give some input in terms of looking at this registry compared to the cancer registry. So some considerations is that the cancer registry, it's a reportable disease. It's congressionally mandated, so we have a strong legal function and behind it, as well as just it's been around a long time, so there's established policies. But the big difference here is you're looking at, did you say you were going to contact the patients in terms of quality of life and function? Because if that's the case, we don't reach, you know, all of the data that goes into the cancer registry is done through chart abstractions, and there's no patient contacts. In fact, we've worked with California before, and they've given special permission for us to contact patients for some other things, and they have a form of, you know, passive consent that we have to, you know, notify. We don't reach out to patients, and in fact, sometimes if we get special permissions to do, we have to send letters in advance to inform them that they're even part of a registry. So there's just a little bit of difference in that way.
So this is
and I'd be happy to answer any questions in that regard.
So this is Leslie Francis, and I just sent you a whole bunch of questions, but I wanted to emphasize the last thing that was just stated, because for many of these reporting registries, people don't even know they're in them.
Yeah, and I think that was, I mean, one of the things that was quite interesting about this scenario was that could have continued to be the case for a number of health systems that were already collecting these kinds of patient-reported outcomes as part of their operations. So in some cases, they could have simply transitioned into a state where they were doing something that's not so different from what's happening with the cancer registry, where they were collecting these during their visits, and then they, instead of just keeping them internally, they transferred them to a registry and then changed the way that patients were informed about this. So that's
like functional status on follow-up visits, and then they would just abstract that rather than talking with the reaching out to the patients.
Yeah, so that was one case that was happening. In other, in the majority of cases, the people had to actually change their workflows to start adding the patient reported outcomes for the purposes of creating this registry. And in those cases, it was more likely that they would be informed that their data might be going into a registry. But the extent to which there's awareness of that, especially when you guys are talking about these cases where someone might be contacted perhaps years into the future.
Yeah.
If that awareness is still something that is retained.
I think it's a great, case scenario, because it really does get at, you're looking at outcomes related to a population, a bunch of people that aren't necessarily, in a clinical trial where there's inclusion and exclusion. So it fits within patient-centered outcome, the goals of patient-centered outcome research, and it's a very real scenario. So thanks for sharing.
So I wanted to give Bob Kalman a chance, because he's had his hands raised, and then Elise, I'm going to come to you next. I also just want to remind folks that if you are not presenting, so if you're not talking, then if you'll just mute your phone, okay? Bob, did you want to go ahead?
Yes, thank you. I have two quick points. One is, if you're looking to get the patient perspective here for a long-term project or a registry, there could be some kind of role for patients, an advisory committee or something along those lines, so that the patient perspective is represented. For a short-term project, that doesn't make any sense, but you can't assume that the IRB is going to represent the patient perspective. And in cases where there is a registry for a known disease where there is active, say, parent participation, it's easy to get an existing organization to serve the role, or at least it's easier. Second point has to do with enforcement, and I think this is something missing from the key questions on the previous slide, and that is, if you're going to have restrictions on data and all kinds of agreements, the question is, how are these things going to be enforced? And that's not an easy question.
And I think that enforcement question is very much, I believe, at the heart of the kind of thing we're trying to untangle with this project. So I suspect there may be some follow-up questions to you along those lines about what is sufficient technically and functionally in order to achieve goals for enforcing, and what policies are actually even feasible to enforce. And we have another scenario, I think, coming up in future meetings that will also dig a little bit deeper into that, I believe.
Then I wanted to give Elise Balona a chance. Elise, go ahead.
So I just want to say that at ARC, we're actually, we funded a orthopedic registry. So I know a lot about this case and about orthopedic registries. And our registry was a research registry, so we did get IRB approval. But there are a couple of characteristics of the registry where I think it might be informative to this group. So one thing is that for orthopedics, you're talking about a two-year follow-up, but the doctor who does the implant isn't seeing the patient for 2 years. So the patient is going to go back. They'll typically go to some sort of larger central hospital for the implant, and then they'll be seen back in their community. So unless you have an integrated system like Kaiser, you're going to lose a lot of patients if you're relying on the site where they had the implant. So, but the other thing is really the patient-centeredness, and I think other people have brought that up. So what we really tried to do in our registry is create a community of patients and make the patients feel like they're part of the process. And that's been so successful, and actually the patients really like having a sympathetic person to talk to. And, you know, we've had people coming for their second hip or knee, and they're like, I'm so happy to be back in this registry. And we really are using the patient as the central source of data collection, both for the PROs and the clinical events, because like looking for which hospital a patient might have gone to for a follow-up event, or, you know, which doctor they might have seen, it's like a needle in a haystack trying to do it through medical records. But by asking the patient, did you have any problems? Did you go to a doctor? Then they tell us which doctor they went to, and then we have permission, because we have IRB approval, to then go and pull the medical record. But we have really, really high follow-up and retention of patients, and and I think that there's so many advantages to doing it that way that and now our registry, the ARC funding is over, and so we are trying to figure out what a sustainability model is. So we kind of came at it from the other way around of saying, okay, we built this research registry. How can it meet other kinds of purposes so that doctors will pay to participate? But, you know, in terms of what's best for patients and being able to collect really high quality data with really high follow-up, we've been hugely successful.
Thanks, Elise. I want to ask Kevin. Kevin, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, so real quick, I just wonder if you've reached out to PCORnet and specifically the Patient Powered Research Networks to get a sense of the 20 or so consent forms that they must have standing up patient registries. It's very, very different from the cancer registry type thing where people don't know they're really being registered from a public health perspective. And back to Peter's point of whether these consents are to only use the data within the confines of the registry and everything would be de-identified versus having and storing and maintaining and updating and keeping current accurate identifiers so that things can be linked to external data sources and having the consent in place to allow for those linkages.
Thanks, Kevin. I mean, Janet, I think that some of this we're going to tackle maybe in sort of the second part of the scenario, right? On a subsequent call, but did you want to comment on that?
No, I mean, I think that I agree that these are really important points, and I do think that we will touch on some of these. One of the things that I'm curious in hearing from you guys, especially this question of sustainability that at least you brought up, but also how that sustainability links in with the things that Kevin and Peter raised. So if patients are going to be kind of at the center of this process, I personally usually associate that with something that is much more expensive sustainability-wise than something that can be run without that engagement process. Is there a sense of how we can maintain that level of patient engagement and also have something that is that has a sustainability model? And, you know, what is the role for that longitudinal data capture and identifiability or re-identifiability in sustainability? So what's, I mean, it sounds like at least the PPRNs and the registry that you're working with at least have been thinking about that. How do all of those requirements fit together?
So this is Elise. So one thing that we did with our registry is we are a certified qualified clinical data registry at CMS. So a lot of you probably know that doctors are going to be required to report quality measures, or they could be part of a qualified clinical data registry, and they will have a decrement in their reimbursement if they aren't. So it basically provides an incentive for doctors to be part of a registry and creates a sustainability model for the registry. The thing that's heartbreaking to me is that there's not enough coordination to really make sure, the reason that the qualified clinical data registries were offered as an alternative is because there is a recognition of the value of registries in quality improvement and research. But on the other hand, there's not enough coordination of saying what is a really good registry or which registry. There's like a lot of registries that are qualified, and not all of them are equivalent in terms of the quality and comprehensiveness of the data collection. So, but another thing that's happening is with the bundled payments, and so for orthopedics in particular, there was just CMS just announced a model of payment for orthopedics. So, where doctors are going to have their own data. So in terms of money to fund it, we're hoping that doctors will agree to pay, because they're going to get this really high quality data back that will help them with their CMS reporting and other things like that. As far as patients, yes, it is expensive to do the kind of patient engagement that we're doing. But another thing that I think is larger than this project, but the question of why aren't PROs routinely captured in doctor visits. And in fact, we had applied, not we, but the registry researchers had applied actually to CMS to do a demonstration where PROs are paid for. So the same way that you do a cholesterol test, you should, and there's some reimbursement associated with it. Why aren't there reimbursements with PROs? It seems like in our patient-centered environment that it should be important for the doctor to have the information from PROs. So, I think that, if PROs were incorporated into electronic health records, then that sustainability would be built in. But
so just picking up on that, this is Peter again, I think to add to what's been said, to the extent that we want to collect this information through the course of routine care, the sustainability really is about making it valuable to not only the downstream research, but to the ongoing care of that patient, and then ultimately the management of that population within the group. And doing that in a way that is efficient and the like. So, again, there are demonstrations that have been done and that others are doing to be able to demonstrate that you can have more consistency in some minimum data set, engage the patient while they're waiting in the waiting room or what have you, to actually contribute some of the information. But the key is that the patient and the provider actually find that information gathering exercise useful for the care of the patient. Because today, that's still the model, right? They're getting paid to take care of the patient, not to do the research. But by doing it that way and making it valuable to them, which is demonstrable, then there's an incentive to continue to do it, because at the end of the day, that's what we really want as clinicians, is to be able to have better information, take care of our patients, and there's better patient engagement. So I think there are ways of encouraging that, but I think also importantly to the point that was made, at some point there is an opportunity cost to any of this activity, right? If it is seen as extra and unnecessary to any degree, then we do have to start thinking about compensation models and ways of essentially overcoming the opportunity cost. In other words, why is it that I'm spending any amount of time as a clinician doing any activity that is not being remunerated, or another way is incentivized? I often say if you define someone's job by what they get paid to do, which is a very reasonable definition of a job, then we have to figure that part out, right?
Thanks, Peter. You know, I want to give Lucy and then Sarah a chance to sort of weigh in with their questions or comments, because I know they've had their hands raised for a while as well. Go ahead, Lucy.
Thank you. I'd like to pick up on what was just said, although I wasn't planning to. I think the idea that you get what you pay for is very deep in American culture, and the whole idea that the research enterprise needs participation from people who just think it's a wonderful idea is really quite profound, and I think it's an ethical issue that you need to flag, whether or not engaging in the research enterprise merits payment. Is it unethical to ask people to devote time and resources or consent or whatever without paying for it? I'm not sure it is, and I'm sure there are many studies where it's not.
The other option, of course, is making sure they get benefits.
Yeah,
the benefits,
I think that's right.
I'm speaking as a patient now who has been approached to participate in research. The benefit is quite abstract. It's quite long-term. This will benefit all mankind or all womankind. The connection of benefit to the patient, I think, is in many cases will be quite implausible, although perhaps an argument can be made.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
The other thing I wanted to note was that there was an article just published in the New England Journal. Maybe you all haven't had the time to look at it, but Daniela, maybe you could take a look at it and see if you wanted to talk to these people. It's called Standardizing Patient Outcomes Measurement, Michael Porter et al., and they refer to what appears to be an international collaboration, the International Consortium for Health Outcomes Measurement, and they want patient meaningful outcomes in the data set. And I'm wondering whether they would have anything to contribute in detail about how to get patients involved in this. They've already established some dozens of sets of outcome measurements with patient input. In other words, what's a meaningful outcome to the patient? So you might want to take a look at this and contact them to see about the workflow to get that patient participation.
Just a quick follow-up to the ethical point. There's some good work, actually a nice article published, I believe it was JAMA 2009 by Ezekiel Emanuel and colleagues, about the ethical imperatives to participate in research and really turning the paradigm on its head, much to the way you've described. And so I think there's clearly a sentiment emerging that is something that needs to be revisited. But I think there's a pragmatic, and I'm a big fan of that, I mean, certainly, but what I've learned the hard way in trying to instrument electronic health record environments to enable research, much to my chagrin, but it's just a pragmatic truth, is that regardless of the ethical imperative, there are economic incentives, and it doesn't have to be money, as you say. It could be other benefits that realized to the participant, be it the patient or the provider. There are ways of incentivizing participation in a number of ways, not the least of which is just making it easier to do the right thing, making it easier and better to actually provide better care, have better interaction, and ultimately have a better patient experience. So there are benefits that don't have to be directly tied to money, but at some point, if it's burdensome, that is going to be a tough hill to climb, even if there's an ethical imperative to do it. So I think it has to be both.
I'd like to
thank you.
I'd just like to follow up to say that I was asked to participate in a study where I was asked to donate a biological sample, and I was told explicitly that I would receive no feedback based on donating this sample, although interesting possibilities from my DNA would be known to the researchers and followed up on and so forth. And my response to that was that this was a little bit exploitative. Like, I'm happy to give a sample if I get some feedback about what's in it.
Yeah.
It's interesting to know what's in it. And researchers explicitly declined to state that they would supply such information. I immediately guessed that they don't have the resources to talk to people individually about what's in their DNA. But I think that was a real weakness of their approach to patients.
So I wanted to give Sarah a chance to also weigh in with a comment or a question. Go ahead, Sarah. And then, Elise, I'm going to go to you, okay?
Hi, thank you. My name is Sarah Putney. And I just wanted to follow up on the sort of broad-ranging discussion of consent issues and patient participation. In my experience, and I have a lot of experience working with IRBs, IRB directors, and sort of from that angle, which I'll comment on in a minute, but I think, you know, the public has widely varying individual attitudes about participating in research and under what circumstances they will. And that's why I think, you know, the fundamental ethical obligation of researchers is to be clear about what the deal is and then let people decide if they want to walk away or participate. And so I think, you know, as Lucy was just describing her experience, it may have been distasteful what the deal was, but she was able to learn about it and decide if she wanted to do it or not. And I think that's really important. I would like to kind of transition to the question, the more practical question, which gives people a lot of headaches, and that is the sort of 20 different IRBs and 20 different opinions dilemma. And I think, in my experience, research institutions have really changed a lot in the past, you know, even 5 years, about being more willing to rely on other IRBs, realizing that even though it is an extra burden for them internally to sort of track the other IRB's activities, it makes the researchers happy. And generally speaking, institutional officials that you know, are connected with IRBs want to keep their researchers happy. So I would tend to think that as a practical matter, maybe requiring or somehow really encouraging the use of a central IRB by participating organizations would be a way of making life easier. And then that kind of goes back to the original dilemma of having different opinions as to whether this project is, you know, fits the federal definition of research or not. And the answer to that question is, you know, has huge consequences, at least for the primary purpose of the registry. Obviously, you know, if you want to have secondary uses for research, then that in some ways is easier to manage. But getting it set up for its primary as a registry is the first hurdle. And on that question, I think it would be very helpful to get an authoritative opinion, you know, perhaps asking OHRP whether they think it's research or not. And then you can kind of go forward with that, because the answer is really has huge implications.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm going to ask Elise. Elise, go ahead.
I just wanted to respond to two things I heard in the previous discussion. I know it's not sort of in order, but one thing about getting back to the patient. So in our registry on orthopedic implants and in another registry, we're just starting on uterine fibroids, that is absolutely what it's like the first rule is that we need to keep patients informed. We need to let them know what their own results are. We need to sort of give them an overview of the results of the study on a regular basis. We need to keep them informed and engaged. I think that is like so important. And, you know, and we do hear though that when we ask people to participate, they do understand there's not going to be a direct benefit to them other than being part of this community. But, you know, they also, people generally understand in our experience that, you know, that they don't have enough evidence to make decisions, and that it will benefit their children to have this evidence. So, you know, that they're doing it for the next generation, and they wish someone had done it for them. So, but we do keep them informed. But the other thing I just wanted to mention, someone mentioned Porter's article in the New England Journal of Medicine and outcome harm innovation. That is another thing that we're really working on a lot at ARC, and that is so important, because in order to incorporate outcome measures in EHRs and clinical practice, you have to agree on which outcome measure you're going to look at. And I just wanted to mention this project called OMERACT, which is in rheumatoid arthritis, and it's really a model for how this kind of outcome harmonization could happen. And what they do, they have a Delphi method, including patients and doctors and companies and FDA and CMS, and all the different stakeholders are there, and the idea is to get everyone to come to agreement, because if FDA agrees on a patient-centered outcome, then the companies that are developing new drugs are going to use that patient-centered outcome. And so by having patients involved in the development of that outcome measure and researchers involved in it, and then quality measures. So if CMS agrees that they're going to measure quality based on that outcome measure, then that outcome measure will be incorporated and routinely measured in the healthcare system. So I think that the OMERACT process is really a model for how things should go forward, where all the different stakeholders at all different levels of the healthcare system get together and decide together what the outcome measure should be.
Thank you, Elise. So this, I know, was a pretty broad sort of discussion, and I think, you know, a number of people sort of pointed us to other work, other related studies. So, you know, we'll certainly look out for some of the papers that you mentioned, but we might also be in touch sort of individually outside the school with, you know, with some more specific questions. Jenna, did you want to make any more comment on this scenario based on the conversation? Otherwise, I'm going to move us to the next one.
I just have one more thing, because I think I would like to follow up with a few of you specifically on this, because the issue of sustainability is tied quite closely to whether or not there's the ethical issue of payments associated with the data. And it, mm-hmm. it seems like some of these cases for sustainability / incentives for participation are really tied closely to whether or not we can track the identity of the patients and their attribution to particular providers. That's true certainly for quality measures, but also for some of these other situations. So I wanted to put a tack in that and potentially draw it out a little bit more, because I didn't go into any detail in thinking about this, and hopefully we'll be able to bring that up in offline discussions with you guys.
Thanks. Yeah, I think this is very helpful input in terms of, you know, other things we can do to sort of round out what we've presented here. Ron, can you bring up the next scenario on sensor data? Go ahead, Daniela.
Okay, so I'm going to apologize in advance, because I made this as complicated as possible to draw out what I think some of the more interesting issues are around patient-generated health data. And just to sort of describe what is meant, at least in this scenario, as patient-generated health data, primarily talking about the kind of data that you'd be getting from devices like Fitbits, things that are not necessarily devices that are included in the purview of the health system itself, but possibly quite relevant to healthcare. So that may differ from what other people's definitions are of PGHD, but I think for the purposes of this scenario, which is thinking of a company and the service that is associated with collecting data of this type and possibly reusing it for other purposes. And so this is also kind of pushing on the different ways that information like this might be used and under different conditions of consent. So I've set this up so that there's a nonprofit research company has been contracted by an employer group that has a workplace wellness program, and participants in that program receive, let's call them healthy sensors. This is something like a Fitbit that monitors physical activity, and if they enroll in this program, they get a 10% reduction in their premium. assuming that they meet their targets for fitness and weight. And so the researcher in question also received IRB approval for a separate study that is not contracted but funded by NIH to use the same data for a different research purpose. So at the time that an employee is enrolling in the original employer-sponsored program, they also have the opportunity to register in a research study. And so some of the participants in the employee wellness program are enrolled in the researcher study, and some of them are not. So the company that's aggregating the data is the device company, so called it Healthy Sensors here, and they allow commercial entities like the employer to get batch data as long as they've engaged in this contractual arrangement, so they can monitor the fitness of their employees on a per member per month fee. And so the researcher is then provided this data in batch downloads so that he can every 3 months analyze the fitness data. And the piggyback study, which is the NIH sponsored study, is also able to access a subset of this data. So this is a kind of scenario where we're trying to get high efficiency out of any one research study by adding additional studies on top of it, but two completely independently funded projects. And we have this issue where we're engaging with a third party that is collecting the data. So there's different ways in which the researcher might obtain consent for the participants. It could be as part of this process of enrollment in the primary employee wellness program, or it could be something that is directed through a device. But with this consent, the analysis will be conducted for the research study. And this is something that's happened to me before. I don't know how many times it's happened to you guys, but the commercial company that was providing data in the middle of a study has changed privacy practices. And so now, in order for data to be released for research, it's the commercial company is actually using a new informed consent process. And so it's probably likely that many of the existing device companies will start using something like Apple Research Kits or other kinds of consent procedures in order to track and inform their users of these kinds of requests to use and release data. But obviously, in this case, there is a study that has been going on for quite some time that predates this new feature that is added to the device. So the questions that I thought we could talk about here in the remaining minutes would be around the complexities of how this kind of three-way relationship between the employer, the researcher as a researcher, the researcher as a contractor, the company and the patient might all be able to play out in a way that we actually do achieve some high degree of ethics for the research case. So what are the obligations of the third party company that is providing the data from the sensors, the device company, was it ethical for the researcher to have this bundled consent for participation in their study when it was bundled into the workplace wellness program? What kind of practices are sort of emerging as best practices for using these kinds of data? I think that we're increasingly seeing some more and more user-friendly practices for informed consent, and people have come to expect a certain level of usability from their devices that they might not expect from informed consent forms that they get on paper in the process of clinical care or other kinds of research participation. So these are sort of emerging standards where I think the technology and the commercial sector is moving much faster than the research sector, and these are questions that have changed the way that patients perceive, or patients or participants perceive, any of the risks or even likelihood that they'll be participating in research. And then some questions here around whether or not things that might be sensitive information would be included in this kind of data set. Are there different kinds of concerns that might be raised in an IRB discussion or in sort of subsequent discussion with patients. And then these sort of the end of this have some questions about whether or not there's identifiability in data that isn't necessarily encoded PII, but things like voice recordings that might be used to detect mood or other kinds of vocal responses to surveys that would be administered using these kinds of apps. It looks like we have 7 minutes left, so hopefully enough time to at least get into some of this.
Would it encourage everyone to ask their questions or make comments quickly? Sarah, your hand is up. Did you have a comment or a question?
No, I didn't. I'm sorry. I guess it's still up.
Okay.
Thank you, though. I'm still trying to digest. There's so many questions, so I didn't right now. Thank you.
Okay, no problem. Did anyone else have a question or a comment on this scenario? Have you been involved in sort of this type of research work, and what have your own experiences been?
I'll just tell you, I haven't been involved. This is Lucy, but it sounds horrifying, and it's one of the reasons that patients who know anything about privacy and security in healthcare and how many people try to honor it, but many people don't, that's potentially a barrier. To me, it's another ethical issue, whether researchers change the rules in the middle of the game so that data that they've collected under one scenario is suddenly used for another, and it becomes an infinite chain with the potential for all sorts of unforeseen, shall we say, uses at the end of the chain. So thanks for bringing this up, because it really does create a morass and maybe shouldn't be okay.
One question that I can bring up to the group is the extent to which people have experience, and I don't know, Peter, if you or anyone else that has done this, is trying to actually use Apple Health Kit or other kinds of approaches for bringing these data back into electronic medical records. It kind of raises this other issue that I didn't think we wanted to get too much into here, because I think there's already so many issues with third parties, but now that there are APIs for bringing these data back into a couple of the major vendors, have any of you had any discussions about what the implications might be for using these data for research?
So just real quick, this is Peter. Bringing the data back into the record from Apple Research Kit is not something we're doing. We do have everybody could use the apparatus of Research Kit locally and use pieces of it to enable consent and the like within your walls. But in terms of how, and we haven't done that, but it's a possibility. And in that case, you could imagine linking the participant with their, ID and the phone and the like, and be able to do that. But when you're talking about using Apple Research Kit the way it's currently designed, where, you put it on the App Store and people download it and the like, the challenge with that is the identifiers and being able to reconcile all that and handle that in a secure way. It's not an easy thing to do. And so we certainly have not tackled that. I'm not aware of anybody who is doing that, but instead is using it more for the kinds of research projects that were initially announced with it, but others may know differently. I'm not aware of it.
This is Sarah. I have actually a question about the facts in this scenario that maybe Daniela could clarify. So as I understand it, the impact of the change in the privacy practice is the users in the wellness program can now provide consent and release their data for research, that it sort of confuses the groups. Is that the implication here? I mean, among others?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that what I was trying to draw out here, and in fact is using that term fairly liberally because this is all hypothetical, but I think these sensors may have been initially rolled out with some understanding from researchers that might be using the data or researchers within the organizations that they would have access to data under terms of use that were in agreement between the aggregating company and the researcher without any consent that necessary. But I think increasingly, and this is certainly a good thing, increasingly that the privacy practices of organizations like these are requiring that there is some kind of consent and information involved in access of other people to these kinds of data. And so that being a major change might change the way that the people that are sort of already sort of tacitly enrolled in a study like this might perceive the activities that are going on in the background with research.
When I was reading the scenario, I'm thinking you're setting up two different types of activities in terms of intent, where one is clearly research and the other looks like a program evaluation to me, more of a non-research quality study. Is that what you intended us to think?
That's the idea, is to sort of say, mm-hmm. How do we look at these things? Do we
right.
look at it differently? Drawing that out a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Jason, you had your hand temporarily up. Did you have a follow-up question, comment?
I just was going to comment, I think a lot of these different scenarios boil down to, at the time of consent, we really need to know the parameters around what would change the patient's decision to consent. So if we knew something about, I'm willing to consent to quality improvement study, but I'm not willing to consent to something else, or if they don't care, I mean, that's important to know. And then it seems like you have that information. Then moving forward, you could exercise more liberal or restricted options on use of data and privacy.
That's really great. Thank you.
So I know we are 2:00, and I know we had sort of a long discussion on the PRO item. So just very quickly, we'll be reaching out to you via email because we want some feedback on some of the other scenarios that we've developed. And we're also going to make an ask in email. We are starting to build up some scenarios related to precision medicine. And we'd be very interested in working with, anyone in this multi-stakeholder group that has some, experience working with genetic data to help us build out these scenarios. Okay, so you'll see 2 emails from us reflecting those asks, okay? Well, then I want to say thank you very much. We appreciate, sort of all the interesting, thoughtful questions you've brought up, and we'll be in touch. Thank you. Have a good rest of the afternoon.
Thank you.
Bye.
This concludes your conference call. We thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.